today on Against the Grain. In his seminal volume, The Wretched of the Earth, the Martinican thinker Frantz Fanon made a number of claims about how colonialism operates and why anti-colonial violence is necessary. I'm C.S. The religious studies scholar An Yante explains and interprets some of Fanon's groundbreaking claims coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Frantz Fanon wore a number of hats: psychiatrist, philosopher, writer, revolutionary. He was Martinican, which is to say he grew up on the Caribbean island of Martinique, which was, when Fanon was born in 1925, a French colony. Fanon is best known for his 1961 book, The Wretched of the Earth, which examines colonialism and its impact on colonized peoples, and which makes a number of claims about violence, including that violence must be used in the anti-colonial struggle. In other words, that in the face of the colonizer's violence, there is no way to overcome colonialism other than by violence. Fanon also describes the plight of colonized people, the ways they are subjugated, their often appalling living conditions, and the Manichaean nature of the colonial world, in which the colonizer paints the colonized as absolute evil. Fanon's claims about violence have been welcomed by many and rejected by some. His ideas continue to resonate with scholars who focus on, and social movements that engage in, the liberation struggles of marginalized and oppressed peoples. An Yante engages with Frantz Fanon's arguments about colonial governance and anti-colonial violence in a chapter he contributed to a new volume called Beyond Man: Race, Coloniality, and Philosophy of Religion. An Yante is Assistant Professor of Religious Studies at California State University, Northridge. He co-edited Beyond Man with Eleanor Craig. Yante agreed to prepare and deliver a talk for Against the Grain based on his chapter about Fanon in Beyond Man. You'll also hear him discuss the project of the book as a whole. Here is An Yante.
Frantz Fanon is a figure who has had an unparalleled influence on various streams of the 20th century anti-colonial thinking and struggle around the world. One of the things that makes him unique is that he was a thinker, a theorist who was also directly involved in the Algerian Revolution. In the essay I wrote titled On Violence and Redemption, Fanon and Colonial Theodicy, I read Fanon's famous essay concerning violence, which is part of his widely read book, The Wretched of the Earth. As I was reading Fanon's essay concerning violence, I could not help but constantly think that where his claims are the most skating, it sounded like a theological analysis or a claim. Of course, he's not talking about religion in the essay. He makes a quick few references to religion here and there, but it's not his main target. Rather, concerning violence is his in-depth diagnosis of the complex layers of violence that constitutes the everyday life of the colonized in the colonial world. The reason why a lot of the charges he levels against colonialism reads like a theological statement to me is because the main focus of his critique is not on a particular aspect of colonialism. He's not just talking about a particular part of colonial politics or racism in general. What we see him do instead in this essay is that he diagnoses colonialism as a much broader problem that pertains to a worldview. Colonialism cannot be reduced to an institution, act, or event that's established socially and politically. Rather, for Fanon, colonialism is all-encompassing. Sure, colonialism conditions material reality, but it has a much broader effect on our existence. It shapes our psyche, culture, value, worldview, social relations. A good part of his argument in the essay is basically his denouncement of colonialism as a worldview, as a metaphysics. And religion is inseparable from worldviews and metaphysics. So the way I read it, even though Fanon does not evoke the word religion as much in the piece, is that he is offering a powerful critique of the theology of colonialism, or better, the colonial theology of whiteness. Now, I understand that many people might find the word theology a little baffling here, especially considering that he's not talking explicitly about religion or theology. Over time, theology has been narrowly construed as a particular, private affair and concept. The scholarly consensus nowadays is that the popular definition of religion and theology that we use today has been heavily influenced by a particular perspective, which is modern, Western, and Protestant. So that the way we understand religion or theology is that it assumes a separate category that already distinguishes religion from other aspects of social and political life. As if this thing called religion, which has been ingrained in the deepest texture of our culture and tradition for thousands of years, no longer exercised any influence in the way we think, form, and organize our society and political institutions. So when I say that Fanon offers a critique of colonial theology, I do not mean an explicit confessional theology done by religious people. Rather, I'm using theology in a much broader sense. In my reading, Fanon is calling out the theological nature of the secular colonial worldview. To him, the secular institution of colonialism and its metaphysics operates in ways that are identical to theology. It is equally as doctrinal, sectarian, exclusionary, enchanting, and redemptionist as any theology. This theology of colonialism, as any good theology would do, offers a solid theological doctrine that justifies the absolute goodness of the divine in the face of prevailing injustice. This doctrine or inquiry is called theodicy. Theodicy is the theological and philosophical articulation that seeks to mediate the tough question of divine justice and the contradicting human reality that points at the prevalence of evil. I am arguing that Fanon offers a critique of colonial theodicy because for Fanon, the colonial metaphysics or worldview is one that continuously legitimizes itself. The reality of the colonial world points at nothing that makes us think of the good and justice. Yet, colonialism and the theology that underpins it constantly reminds the colonized that the current system and order is good and just. For Fanon, this is a world shaped by a strict dualism in which the white colonizer and their norms and values represents absolute good, while the native, brown, black, colonized, points at evil. In short, colonialism operates like religion here. The figure of the absolute sovereign God is always good and just. And while the everyday reality of the human being might be filled with atrocious violence, causing the human horrific suffering, it doesn't put God's justice on trial. Because the theological answer to the question of evil and divine justice will always point at some kind of flaw or weakness on the side of the human. It will never question the inherent goodness and justice of God. Likewise, the reality of the colonized who inhabit the abandoned ghettos, whose lives are constantly conditioned by violence, for whom living is not so much about flourishing, but the struggle to survive and avoid death. Their horrendous situation does not pose a fundamental threat to the global order that maintains this starkly contrasting everyday reality of the white colonizer, the reality of the first world inhabitants. If anything, the colonized is taught to emulate the white colonizer, to be more like them, and abandon their inferior, that is, evil nature.
That's Anne Yante delivering a talk about Frantz Fanon's thought, a talk based on an essay Yante contributed to the volume Beyond Man, Race, Coloniality, and Philosophy of Religion. Anne Yante, who co-edited the volume with Eleanor Craig, is Assistant Professor of Religious Studies at California State University, Northridge. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Let's return to more of Yante's talk.
The central rationale that the answer to the problem of evil uses to explain the unjust reality is often the logic of redemption. And this is true in both religious context and in secular context. Key to redemption is the notion of sacrifice. In other words, redemption is inevitably connected to violence, one way or the other. In the religious context, particularly Christianity, I think it is pretty evident that sacrifice is at the heart of the Christian notion of redemption. The most innocent being dying to save the sinful humanity. Or another good example is the biblical story of Job, which I use in my essay. Job is depicted as a flawless human and a faithful believer. All of a sudden, he goes through an unfathomable loss. He loses his wealth as well as his children. Rather than questioning divine justice and goodness, Job endures it. Fast forward, the narrative ends with Job earning the title of a faithful servant and being paid off for all the losses he suffered. He's blessed with more wealth and children than before. And here we have the classic example of a theodicy, that is, the problem of evil relying on redemptive logic. The Bible doesn't spend a sentence on the meaning of those lost lives. What matters is that Job has endured his test and that now he's better off than before. The lost lives are mere sacrifices, instrumental to the story of redemption. In Fanon's colonial context, the same redemptive logic of sacrifice and exclusion is at the heart of the mechanism of the colonial worldview. He says, "Many are called, but few are chosen." This is an explicit Christian reference. Redemption is open to all in the colonial world. Yet, it is not for all because redemption requires sacrifice. For only those who fully subscribe to the colonial narrative of redemption and become faithful followers of it might earn the privilege of redemption. One contemporary thinker who helps us to understand the theological logic of redemption, sacrifice, and violence in the political arena better is the Cameroonian philosopher and theorist Achille Mbembe. Mbembe contributes to the discussions in contemporary political and legal theory in which scholars have long tried to theorize the notion of sovereignty, the central concept that operates at the heart of modern and contemporary politics. Scholars have pointed out that the operation of power in governance, especially from the perspective of the modern notion of the state, is grounded in the concept of sovereignty. We tend to think about the liberal state as operating under the amicable idea of contract. But at the heart of its mechanism, critics argue, lies the notion of the sovereign, who is above the law and governs by will, that is, decision, rather than contract. And decision inevitably comes with exclusion, since you're always choosing one option among others. Briefly, two things we can draw from this analysis. One, the fact that governance relies on decision, which could often be extrajudicial, implies that violence constitutes politics and political life. Two, these critics commonly point out that the figure of the sovereign is modeled after the old Christian imaginary of the sovereign. In other words, essentially what they're saying is that the mechanism of violence that constitutes our political imagination and system is, in a way, influenced by religion or theological imagination. Achille Mbembe takes a step further and applies this concept globally, particularly in the global colonial situation. He coined the famous concept of necropolitics, the politics of death. For him, the constitution of Western political life involves the sovereign decision on who may live and who must die. The post-colonial Africa is largely the site of this politics of death. Simply speaking, the global politics that allows flourishing life to Western, that is white, people, is inseparable from the political decision that simultaneously distributes death to black colonial Africans. We can find in Mbembe's incisive critique many of the concepts I discussed earlier in Fanon, such as the strictly dualistic worldview, in which one side belongs to good and normative values, whereas the other side points at the opposite, or the redemptionist politics that promises life at the expense of sacrifice and exclusion. This takes us to the broader question of violence, which is the main topic of Fanon's essay, the first chapter of his book, The Wretched of the Earth. Fanon's essay has been a constant object of controversy since its publication for his defense of the use of violence in anti-colonial struggle. He's been often mischaracterized as a proponent of violence, which is ironic because this essay is a strong and compelling critique of violence. This misreading and mischaracterization is largely based in two different points that need to be clarified. First, those who criticize Fanon fail to consider the ways in which violence already constitutes the political, which I explained a minute ago when I was talking about Achille Mbembe's necropolitics. Second, they articulate a violence in a teleological or utilitarian understanding. Both teleological and utilitarian basically refers to goal-oriented. They are result-oriented. So from a teleological or utilitarian perspective, violence is a tool, the means to achieve a certain fixed outcome. I'll explain these two points a little more. First, as I said already, politics is already constituted by violence. The growing and flourishing ideal of political liberalism in 19th century Europe largely turned a blind eye to the problem of slavery and colonialism, while passionately advancing its ideal of equality for all. Likewise, contemporary discourse of Western liberal democracy is inseparable from extrajudicial acts of killing and violence. It sanctions in numerous parts of the world today. Fanon provides a detailed account of what life means for a person whose everyday life is conditioned by the ubiquitous violence that affects both physical and psychic dimension of the colonized. He says, "To colonize is free only when he is asleep. The colonized is constantly forced to ask the question, who am I in reality? Life is not so much about achievement in the colony, but survival." The critique of violence that often comes from the liberal tradition of thought does not consider the way in which violence is already at play in our everyday life. The question Fanon raises is, what does it mean to resort to nonviolence when the discourse of nonviolence already operates within the orbit of violence? He says that the discourse of nonviolence is introduced to the colony by the colonial bourgeoisie, who wants to settle the problem around the negotiating table before the irreparable is done.
His name is An Yante. He teaches in the Department of Religious Studies at Cal State Northridge. Yante is co-editor of the new volume Beyond Man, Race, Coloniality, and Philosophy of Religion, published by Duke University Press. To that volume, Yante contributed an essay about the arguments Frantz Fanon presented in his seminal book, The Wretched of the Earth, especially its first chapter entitled Concerning Violence. You are listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. We go back now to more of An Yante's remarks.
As the Lebanese-Australian critic Ghassan Haj points out, often the liberal discourse of violence and nonviolence normalizes certain forms of violence while pathologizing others. The denouncement of certain forms of violence takes place alongside the simultaneous legitimation of other forms of violence. To get to the second point, a teleological view understands violence as the means to achieve a certain goal. Fanon proposes the notion of absolute violence, which begs a distinction from such view. To be clear, Fanon's articulation of violence includes the armed revolution. He is in the middle of an armed revolt himself, and he is partly addressing this particular event of violence. You do certainly need to rely on any possible means to overthrow the colonial regime, and that could include violence. However, absolute violence, as he envisions, is one that cannot be reduced to a particular historical event. Decolonial violence as absolute violence cannot be contained by the framework of means and ends. It is not about achieving a certain goal, which usually means replacing the current system with another. Rather, it is a concept that always evokes an elsewhere. It is something that is always in excess, beyond the particularity of the present. This might sound like a highly abstract concept, and so in order to illustrate this idea with more clarity, I draw a parallel with Walter Benjamin's critique of violence, which bears a strong similarity with Fanon's notion of violence. Benjamin draws the distinction between what he calls mythic violence and divine violence. Mythic violence is one that happens in the present age, while the latter is indiscernible in history. For Benjamin, mythic violence is a kind of violence that operates under the principle of power. It is the violence that destroys, subdues, kills. It demands sacrifice and destruction. It is, I would say, what we usually understand by violence in the common sense of the term. What's important is the contrasting notion of divine violence. Benjamin's divine violence, too, is absolute violence in the sense that it is not reduced to or even contained in present acts. Divine violence destroys mythic violence, and it refuses closure, meaning it is not goal-oriented, and it does not assume completion. Another helpful example for understanding this would be to use the French political philosopher Georges Sorel's work, on whom Benjamin is drawing in this essay. Sorel makes the distinction between the political general strike and proletarian revolution. The former, that is, political general strike, operates within the orbits of violence because it seeks to invert the power relation. So even when the goal of the strike is successfully achieved, the fundamental mechanism of violence and oppression that conditions the society is left untouched in a way. In contrast, proletarian strike aims at abolishing the order in which social relations of power and domination are constituted. Both Benjamin's and Fanon's notion of absolute violence is close to Sorel's notion of proletarian revolution in that it is not about inverting or replacing or building anew, but abolishing the existing order, the current grammar and term in which everything operates. It is a radical rejection and a demand for a radical otherwise. I conclude my essay by drawing on the Italian Marxist Antonio Negri's work. Negri published an interesting book on the biblical story of Job, in which he offers a materialist reading of the biblical narrative. He reads Job's expression of his frustration not as a passive form of self-loathing, as traditional scholarship has interpreted it, but a direct confrontation with the sovereign. For Negri, Job's epiphany is not so much a story of Job seeing the divine out of his own wretchedness, as it is the proclamation of the death of God, as Job's proclamation of the end of transcendence. In Job's epiphany, he says, "I've heard about God, but now I have seen you with my own eyes." Negri reads this passage as Job demystifying God from absolute transcendence. God justifies himself. Thus, God is dead. I take cue from this reading and suggest that we read Fanon's indignation against colonial worldview, that is, the colonial theology, as a Fanonian proclamation of the end of transcendence. If traditional theodicy seeks the answer to the problem of divine justice, Fanon interrogates and rejects the secularized order that continuously feeds itself through violence. He demystifies the colonial order and its theology and theodicy by proclaiming the death of God, the death of the theology that makes the white colonizer God, the theology that rationalizes the unjust colonial order. By way of concluding, I would like to briefly talk about two points. They're part of one big question about the problem of gender and hypermasculinity in Fanon. There's an extensive body of literature that analyzes Fanon's often skewed view of gender. They have rightly pointed out that Fanon reduces women's contribution to anti-colonial struggle and that he struggles with a certain anxiety about his own masculinity. Because of this unresolved issue of gender, some would argue that Fanon advocates certain ideas and tactics that in a way reproduces a masculinist notion of antagonistic politics based in violence. To a certain extent, many such observations are valid. It's undeniable that Fanon's view of gender is problematic and that he struggles with a certain hyper-masculinist desire, a desire that is inseparably linked to the colonial racial anxiety. The colonial ideal of the human is not only racialized, but also gendered. It operates on a binary that associates the white colonizer with masculinist traits and the colonized with effeminate images. Without invalidating the feminist critique, I want to point out a slightly different side of Fanon that often parallels his masculinist desire and anxiety. Fanon's moments of affirming a certain sense of mastery and masculinity is often followed by a sense of vulnerability and openness that he does not shy away from. A hasty association of Fanon's violence with masculinity might eclipse the deep longing for openness, alterity, care, and love that Fanon's writing continuously signals. Fanon's understanding of the self reflects such desire and opening. He is deeply influenced by the phenomenological existential tradition of philosophy that views the self as inseparably linked to the other. That is, the self is never a complete and fully self-constituted entity. Rather, the self only exists because of the other who recognizes me. In that sense, the self is always already given to the world, a world that is constituted by countless others. Understanding his view of the self in relation to the other, it is no strange that his thought and vision are always oriented towards the other.
That's the voice of An Yante, a religious studies professor at California State University, Northridge. I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. And we asked Yante to prepare and present a set of remarks about how he interprets Frantz Fanon's stances on colonial rule and anti-colonial violence, stances Fanon presented in his landmark volume, The Wretched of the Earth, first published in 1961. An essay on Yante wrote about Fanon is part of the volume Beyond Man, Race, Coloniality, and Philosophy of Religion, which Yante also co-edited. He's also the author of The Decolonial Abyss, Mysticism and Cosmopolitics from the Ruins. His name is spelled A-N-Y-O-U-N-T-A-E. We turn now to Yante's talk about the volume Beyond Man as a whole, the motivation for writing it, its overarching themes, and some of the topics addressed in the book's various chapters.
Beyond Man is an attempt to interrogate a certain normative framework that forms the discipline of philosophy of religion. It is no secret that the modern and 20th century scholarship of philosophy has produced universalizing claims that reinforce a worldview which places the West as the normative reference of knowledge. For a long time, philosophers believed that the particular form of knowledge produced in the West represents the universal truth about the world that transcends contested geographies of power. As if philosophical claims lie beyond the existing power relations that are informed by the colonial condition and the problem of race. We do see finally a change that's starting to happen in the field of philosophy. There's been many interventions in recent decades that started to address the problem of race and colonialism in which philosophy is implicated. And there is still a long way to go. But what caused the attention is how such change is absent in the field of philosophy of religion. In 2021, you're still not going to find one single volume written in English that addresses philosophy of religion and race or colonialism, with the exception of maybe one or two volumes. Almost the entire canon of philosophy of religion is reserved for white European thinkers. When a non-Western thinker makes it to the list, it's usually approached from a comparativist perspective, in which the normative framework in comparison is still largely Euro-Christian. When looking at the Americas, there's a large and important trajectory of thought that comes from Black radical traditions, indigenous and other subjugated communities who have continuously presented crucial challenges and insights for thinking about the human, the world, and religion. This trajectory is largely neglected in the conversations about philosophy of religion. An important contribution that the recent post-colonial and decolonial scholarship has made is they help us understand the complex historical layer underneath the constitution of the modern Europe. These critics show us that modern Europe, or West, is not a self-constituted idea or worldview. The very idea of the modern West, its rise to the central place of world history, its view of itself and the rest of the world, is a direct product of its colonial enterprises in which race played a key function. The invention of Europe and European man as the central subject of universal history, as many modern philosophers have articulated, was not purely a philosophical articulation that was created out of a vacuum by accident. Rather, it was their projection or production of racialized and colonial others that made their understanding of themselves possible. This means that even a seemingly innocent philosophical articulation about the world and the human being already carries colonial and racializing assumptions that was provided by the violent global order that they had created. The role of religion in these political and philosophical endeavors cannot be underestimated when you consider that philosophy and theology have always shared common roots and trajectories, often crisscrossing each other. Likewise, those who challenged the dominant worldview and order do present important challenges to the question of religion, even when their writings might not be presented as philosophy of religion as such. So at the base of our inquiry lies the fundamental question that seeks to rethink the very definition, boundary, and practices that constitutes a discipline. What makes something philosophy of religion, and what makes something not? Or even a more important question would be, what makes something religion, and what makes it not? What are the implications and consequences that such boundary drawing practices have? What happens when we say, okay, this is real philosophy, and this is not? Okay, this is religion, and this is not. Our observation is that those boundaries are questionable, to say the least. Many of the neglected interventions that we try to reilluminate present alternatives that defy those violent boundaries, hierarchies, and orders of knowing and being. Aside from myself and my co-editor, Eleanor Craig, we have gathered a group of contributors who are making important interventions in the field of religion, race, colonialism, and philosophy. Their essays cover a wide range of issues, including secularism, the Eucharist's relation to blackness, and the 16th century Brazilian cannibalism rituals, just to name a few. Many of the contributors also highlight the theorizing of Afro-Caribbean thinkers such as Sylvia Winter, C.L.L. James, Amos Ezer, and Frantz Fanon. These radical thinkers' work, we argue, disrupt the normative Western categories of religion and philosophy.
An Yante, assistant professor of religious studies at California State University, Northridge. He was talking about the new volume Beyond Man, Race, Coloniality, and Philosophy of Religion, which he co-edited with Eleanor Craig. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. You may have recently heard Michael Staudenmayer interviewed on this program about the internal colonization of Chicanos and Puerto Ricans living in the U.S. Mike spoke to me about the trajectory of the MLN, a group active in the late 1970s and early 80s that brought together Puerto Rican nationalists and Chicano militants in the U.S. We didn't have time to present the entire interview I taped with Mike, and so here is a previously unaired excerpt about a form of state repression directed at Chicano, Puerto Rican, and other radicals in the U.S. that often goes unnoticed and unreported.
The role of grand juries is in some ways, as you put it, it's a legal process. The creation of a grand jury is part of the legal process to determine whether or not to charge someone with a crime. This is the opportunity for, in this case, the U.S. attorney to do some digging and try and find out what happened, if they believe that a crime had been committed, and who might be responsible. And one of the things that can happen at a grand jury is that you can call witnesses. Now, often, in the case of these sorts of criminal investigations, the witnesses are people who might be worried that they would themselves be suspects, and therefore they're not necessarily interested in testifying. And as a result, this goes back, I believe, to English common law. Grand juries have the power to issue subpoenas in exchange for a form of immunity, so that the people who are called to testify at the grand jury are told, you will not be charged with a crime based on whatever your testimony is. And in exchange, we can force you to testify, and a judge can enforce those subpoenas if people refuse to testify in spite of that form of immunity that they receive. The judge can put people in jail. Now, this is not a criminal conviction. That is a possibility, and it actually happens in the early 80s to a handful of members of the MLN. They serve several months of a prison sentence having been convicted of what's called criminal contempt of court. But usually, and what happens in 1977 after the founding of the MLN, is something called civil contempt. It's simply a determination by the judge that people who had been, you know, lawfully called to testify in front of a grand jury and had been given immunity had refused to testify, and so we put them in prison to get them to change their minds. That can last several months. Usually grand juries have a specific time limit. They have to come to an end, and when the grand jury expires, then those people have to be let out of jail. And that's what happens to, again, several of the founding members of the MLN. And that leads to a whole analysis that's promoted by the MLN and a number of other factions of the US left that says the grand jury is itself a weapon of state repression, because what you're doing, if you're thinking about it from the perspective of the federal prosecutors, is you're taking these activists off the street for a period of time. You know that they are committed not to testifying, in part because they're worried that it will, you know, negatively impact some of their comrades, maybe people in the organization who weren't called to testify, who might actually be the target of these investigations, or people who aren't in the MLN but are Puerto Rican independence activists. Again, there's an active armed struggle going on at this time with a number of people who are effectively living underground. They are the likeliest targets of these investigations. They're not being given immunity. And so if you do testify, then you could put some of your close comrades at risk. So the prosecutor understands that in advance, realizes these people aren't going to testify. Well, then it's win-win. If they do testify, then you can get good information out of them that can help you put these other people behind bars. And if they don't testify, then you get to put them behind bars, the would-be witnesses, and they can't be out in the streets organizing protests and rallies and demonstrations. So that's the power of the grand jury as a tool of state repression. And it's one of the things that the MLN really is kind of forged in the fire of this movement of grand jury resistance. And it becomes a central piece of their analysis of the state, and some of their ideas of fascism are really, you know, based on this direct personal experience of being put into prison without ever having been convicted of a crime, which seems in the United States like something that's not supposed to happen, and yet through the format of the grand jury and the concept of civil contempt, it happens fairly routinely in the 1970s, targeting especially Puerto Rican and Mexicano radicals.
You mentioned the repression directed against, I believe, the Puerto Rican independence movement in the U.S. in the mid-1970s. What happened in the mid-1970s?
In the mid-1970s, the movement for Puerto Rican independence is really gaining steam, and it's doing so in a number of different venues or locations, both in Puerto Rico itself and in the diaspora, meaning inside the United States proper. And it's doing so through a number of different organizational entities. And in the midst of that upsurge in pro-independence sentiment, a small underground armed organization emerges that's called the FALN, is the Spanish acronym. The English name is the Armed Forces of National Liberation. And the FALN starts a fairly small-scale bombing campaign. They engage in a number of these attacks, mostly but not exclusively targeting property rather than people. And the objective, if you read their communiques at the time, is to kind of heighten the contradictions around U.S. colonialism and hopefully build the willpower and morale of Puerto Ricans to fight colonialism, not necessarily that all other Puerto Ricans are going to join the armed struggle, but that they'll be inspired in some way. That doesn't necessarily really happen. And by the time we get to the 1980s, the independence movement is in some ways in decline. But in that moment of the mid-70s, it doesn't look like that's going to happen. It looks like we might actually have a real fundamental break with the long history of U.S. colonialism in Puerto Rico. So these various wings of the movement are operating more or less simultaneously, but not always, you know, in full agreement with each other. There are lots of Puerto Rican independence activists who are not happy that the FALN is conducting these bombing campaigns. And one of the things that's distinctive about the MLN is that from the very beginning, they are publicly enthusiastic about armed struggle, including being actively supportive of the FALN. I sometimes use the analogy that the MLN is effectively the Sinn Féin to the FALN's IRA, right? Using the old Irish revolutionary model from the 20th century, that Sinn Féin is a legal political organization functioning in Ireland and in the United Kingdom as a political party, effectively, where the IRA is obviously an illegal armed organization. Something roughly comparable is sort of the case as the MLN kind of gets off the ground. And so the period of the mid-70s is this really kind of dynamic and generative moment for the Puerto Rican independence struggle. And the MLN is one of many manifestations of that kind of upsurge of new ideas and new directions for the independence movement in that era.
Michael Staudenmeyer, assistant professor of history at Manchester University in Indiana. We were talking about his article, America's Scapegoats, Ideas of Fascism in the Construction of the U.S. Latina, Latino, Latinx Left, 1973-83, which appeared in the journal Radical History Review. And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.